Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, recognizing the value of financial advice since 1937. Putnam Investments, a world of investing. Produced in association with the University of Southern California.
Now here's a thought for a Friday. What a difference a week makes in the debt limit talks, huh? Oh, no, wait, never mind. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Progressive Insurance with Snapshot, which monitors mileage and safe driving habits to determine a personalized rate. Learn more at progressive.com. Marketplace Innovation Reporting is supported by the 2011 Jaguar XJ. Learn more at a local dealer or at jaguarusa.com.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. It's Friday today, the 22nd of July. This one is good as always to have you with us. The big news of the week was the big news of last week, and as it happens, the big news of the week before: debt and the limiting of it. So here with the latest and a prognostication or two are John Carney from CNBC, also Lizzie O'Leary from Bloomberg News. Hey, guys.
Hi.
Thanks for having us.
So, Ms. O'Leary, you are in Washington, D.C. You have your finger on the very pulse of these negotiations. What's the latest today?
Yeah.
Okay. So,
look, the only two people know, Barack Obama and John Boehner. And until they feel like telling us on Monday, that's sort of where we stand, despite a lot of back and forth in all the various caucuses.
Well, let me throw you another one then, sort of sideways. The Gang of Six talks that sort of broke this week. Senator Warner was on the broadcast the other day, said, you know, I hope we can get some stuff in there that's going to be a bigger deal. Any sign of that happening?
There may be a bigger deal. It's probably not going to be the Gang of Six one, because at a certain point you run out of time. The way the legislative clock works, if you time backwards, that means you probably need to see a plan on Monday. The House has got to vote on Wednesday, and the Senate's got to see the language on Wednesday, which means we are seriously in crunch time. And the president and John Boehner are looking at something in the $3 trillion neighborhood. There's also potentially another track going where there's maybe a $1.5 trillion cut package that the House might be willing to look at. And then you got the McConnell thing sitting in the wings.
All right. You know what? I should have stayed with your original answer, which was, I don't know. John Carney, here's the thing. We are now honestly getting close to it. I know we've been saying that for a month. I'm still waiting for the markets to go haywire. You?
The markets don't believe that a deal won't get done. I think they're way too wildly optimistic. You have some very realistic people who think, you know, and very practical people working inside of financial institutions in New York who think, well, of course they're going to be able to come to an arrangement. We have negotiations all the time, and we fight with each other and we battle. But eventually we come to an agreement, shake hands across the table, and a deal gets done. They don't really anticipate what could really be true, which is that a deal might not get done.
John, do you actually believe that?
I think Boehner has a very hard position. He needs to get at least half of his caucus to vote for whatever deal he makes with Obama. He can't do anything unless he can get half the Republicans, that's 120 Republican House members, to vote with him. Because if he doesn't get the majority, guess what? If he tries to pass a Obama debt ceiling deal without the majority of his caucus, they'll fire him. He won't be House Speaker anymore, and he's not willing to risk that.
Lizzie, give me your gut. Deal or no deal by the time this thing really gets down to it?
My gut says deal and a small one. But I had a very plugged-in senior Senate aide tell me today he thinks it's big deal or nothing. So that shows you what I know.
Let me take advantage, Lizzie, of Bloomberg's reporting money. They sent you out to South Carolina this week. You talked to regular people about how they're feeling about this whole debt thing. What'd they say?
Well, it's important to note I went to the district of a Tea Party member who was one of the sponsors of Cut, Cap, and Balance. Mick Mulvaney says Treasury could prioritize the debt. We won't default even if we don't raise the debt ceiling. Economists disagree. His constituents were pretty split. We did have a lot of people say to us, we don't believe the president anymore. We don't believe Secretary Geithner. At the same time, I went to see a local financial advisor there, and he was getting a lot of calls from his clients who were worried, who were actually starting to get a little nervous.
So, John, talk to me about that worry for a second. What can, if Congress somehow, in its infinite wisdom, doesn't arrange for this to happen, and the president and Boehner can't make a deal, what does it look like? What happens?
Well, first of all, there are other alternatives. It's possible, and an old law professor of mine wrote this in the New York Times, that Obama should just claim, you know, sort of exigent circumstances, break the law, and bust the debt ceiling. Abraham Lincoln did it during the Civil War, saying, "It's you know, I will break one law in order to prevent the ruin of all laws." And I wouldn't be surprised. I mean, remember that the federal government did all sorts of extraordinary, unimaginable things during the financial crisis. And if we get down to it, and that debt ceiling's coming, Obama doesn't want to be the one who defaults. Remember, what they're going to stop doing is stop making Social Security payments, start paying military and other government workers in IOUs. But I do not believe Obama wants to go down as the president who defaulted. He'd rather go down as the president who broke the law that had paralyzed Congress and, you know, live with that rather than the guy who wrecked the financial system.
John Carney from CNBC, Lizzie O'Leary from Bloomberg News. It keeps getting more interesting, this story does. Thanks, guys. Have a good weekend.
Thanks, Kai.
On Wall Street today, since we were just talking about it, tech up, blue chips down. We will have the details when we always have the details. In the truest sense of the phrase going out of business, liquidation sales started at 399 soon-to-be former Borders bookstores today. After being unable to find a buyer for the whole business, Borders is unloading everything from books to DVDs to the very furniture we used to sit on while perusing the shelves. We sent Marketplace's Stacey Vanek Smith to check out one of the closeout sales.
I remember when Borders first opened in my hometown. It was enormous, and everybody was there. Little did I know, a couple decades later, I'd be at their liquidation sale. At a Borders in New York City, the line wound through the store, which is pretty unusual, according to longtime customer Tessa Sutter.
But it's usually super quiet, so it's sort of got a library vibe, which is quite nice.
Well, not for the bottom line. Borders declared bankruptcy in February, and now it's selling everything. Book industry consultant Mike Schatzkin says Borders made some mistakes, but essentially was overwhelmed by online stores like Amazon.
So when Borders started, the best place to go if you had to look for something was a place that had 125,000 titles in it. Now the best place to go is online, where you can choose from 3 or 4 million titles.
Yes, I've been sort of watching the Borders decline for a few years now, and I'm very, very sad about it.
That's Nell Hanlon. I caught up with her in line buying cookbooks, classical music CDs, and some BBC films. But even she admitted to using her cell phone to compare prices as she picked over the remains at Borders.
I did put a few things back because I can either get them on the Kindle for cheaper or I can purchase them on Amazon for cheaper.
Wait a minute. Even the prices at Borders liquidation sale can't compete with Amazon? Not that there weren't bargains.
No, the complete cartoons of The New Yorker.
For $19.99, you can't beat that online. And while I was in line, I saw The Grapes of Wrath and a DVD of Footloose. Those impulse buys brought my bill to almost $80. In New York, I'm Stacey Vanek Smith for Marketplace.
Shopping on company time, I don't know. A year ago today, Congress gave up on its big climate change bill. It's the one that had cap and trade in it, an actual market for pollution that conceivably could have re-engineered the whole energy economy. Last week, the House voted on light bulbs. The GOP wants to block new energy efficiency rules. So from the Marketplace Sustainability Desk, Scott Tong has more on what a long, strange year it's been in green energy policy.
A year ago, companies, inventors, and investors were planning for the new math of energy, financial carrots for low-carbon emitters, sticks for fossil fuel producers. Now executives come to town and...
The term worthless has come out a number of times.
Tim Griff is with the Clean Economy Network. Its members include new energy companies.
It's the level of silliness, which was similar to having styrofoam cups, you know, proactively put back in the cafeteria and the House office buildings. I mean, there's moves that are more out of political spite than out of any sense of intelligence.
The gridlock has some companies undoing big bets. Utility giant AEP just canceled a $668 million plan to capture carbon dioxide from coal smokestacks. The project assumed government credits, or money, for cutting emissions. At least 4 similar carbon capture ventures have been canned lately. Venture capitalist Rob Day at Black Coral Capital says in many cases, federal help doesn't make or break an energy investment. It's more of a tailwind.
There wasn't a determining factor as to whether somebody made an investment or not, but at the same time, it does affect overall momentum and enthusiasm.
For now, business has to make its own case, and in many clean tech sectors, it does. Investment bank HSBC expects the world's low-carbon market to triple to $2 trillion by 2020. In Washington, I'm Scott Tong for Marketplace.
The magic number in New York City this weekend is 784. That's the number of gay and lesbian couples who will be able to get married on the first day that gay marriage is legal in the Empire State. Mayor Michael Bloomberg down in New York City said today he will officiate the first one. Many thousands more will surely follow. But not everybody is doing it just for love. From the Marketplace Health Desk at WHYY, Gregory Warner explains.
Clay Williams is just in the early stages of wedding planning. He doesn't have a date or a venue yet. He just knows that they'll have two priests, Episcopal and Buddhist, and that it'll go down somewhere in New York City.
And it's going to be a good party.
Clay proposed to his longtime partner, David Groff, in December. But if they didn't want to get married, they'd have to, for the least romantic reason, health insurance. They're both covered under a domestic partner policy through Clay's employer. There's a clause in that policy that Clay signed back when he was hired. It says if their state legalizes same-sex marriage, they'd have to marry to keep getting benefits.
Yes.
So you looked at that and you kind of thought eventually...
I had no idea. This was more than 10 years ago. Massachusetts, Vermont, all that stuff, none of it had happened. So at that time, it seemed, you know, who knows when this could happen.
There's a large number of people in the lesbian and gay community who are shocked and angry that they now have to get married in order to retain their benefits or to get them in the first instance.
Catherine Frankie directs the Center for Gender and Sexuality Law at Columbia Law School.
Why are those employers in the business of promoting marriage?
Well, it's about equity.
Helen Darling heads the National Business Group on Health. She says almost all companies require their heterosexual employees to marry to get benefits, so the same standard should apply to gay employees as well, if laws permit. Professor Frankie answers that even if states allow it, there are federal or military rules that can penalize same-sex couples.
So they've got to make a choice, health benefits or military pension, health benefits or paying higher federal taxes. It's not simple, easy, across-the-board equality the way that some employers think it might be.
Of course, it's the minority of employers that even offer domestic partner policies. Most employers treat marriage as the only standard for getting your partner insured. So New York's vote to expand the right to marry will mean a lot more couples getting health benefits, not losing them. In Philadelphia, I'm Gregory Warner for Marketplace.
Coming up, Google Plus has businesses all of Twitter.
I've never kind of felt the urgency like this before.
Get it? All of Twitter. But first, let's do the numbers. The Dow Industrials lost 43 points this Friday, about a 3%, closed at 12,681. The NASDAQ up 24 points, nearly 0.9%, finished at 2,858. The S&P 500 inched up a single point, also a single tenth of 1%, as it turns out. Ended the day at 1,345. For the week gone by, the Dow scored a gain of 1.6%. The NASDAQ jumped 2.5%. The S&P 500 added 2.2% today. Caterpillar missed its mark despite a 44% jump in profits. The construction equipment maker shares commensurately sank 5.75%. General Electric turned in respectable profitable growth, but its stock dimmed 2.33%. Bond prices rose. The yield on the 10-year T-note fell back to 2.96%. You're listening to Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Indiana University's Kelley School of Business, providing a personalized approach to career advancement. Learn more at kellei.iu.edu. And by LendingTree, providing up to 4 loan offers from a network of lenders. Learn more at LendingTree.com or 1-800-555-8733. For more about the latest business and economic news from Marketplace, visit Marketplace.org to discover even more of the news you love from Marketplace.
Thank you.
Balance your life with dollar signs. Tune in to Marketplace Money this weekend for a look at the issues affecting your wallet. Whether it's investing, renting an apartment, or sending your kid off to college, we'll help you navigate.
Marketplace Statebook, here's a look at events coming up Monday. The National Council of La Raza continues its annual conference in Washington. The meeting addresses critical issues in the Hispanic community. President Obama is scheduled to speak. Secretary of State Hillary Clinton returns from a whirlwind trip that included Greece, India, and China. And the United Nations convenes a high-level meeting on youth at its headquarters in New York. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from APM American Public Media. I'm Kai Rizdal. The housing market is stagnant, might be a good word. Depressed might be another that you could apply to prices. Rental prices, meanwhile, are on the rise. So the government is looking at a plan to rent out some of the foreclosed homes it owns through Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac. Nick Timmeros has the story in the Wall Street Journal today. Nick, welcome to the program.
Well, thanks for having me.
So lay it out for us. What is this plan all about?
Well, the idea here is that the government is selling through Fannie Mae or Freddie Mac or federal agencies, tens of thousands of homes every month through foreclosure. And can we get the government to maybe rent them out instead so we don't have all these foreclosures coming onto the market driving prices down?
Is there a way to know, if you take the distress sales out, how much foreclosures are driving down prices?
Well, since the housing crisis began 5 years ago, all home prices have been going down at roughly the same pace, distressed and non-distressed. But what we've seen over the last 6 months is that if you take distressed sales out of the equation, the price of non-distressed homes actually has stabilized, but all home prices are looking lower now because of foreclosures. The problem is if you have somebody who's willing to buy your house for $200,000, but there's a foreclosure on the block that just sold for $175,000, an appraiser is going to say, well, your house is only worth $175,000,
right,
and that can blow up the deal because the lender's not going to give a loan on a house at $200,000. They're going to say, well, it really needs to be $175,000. That's the problem that foreclosures are creating for housing markets right now.
Okay, but riddle me this. Doesn't this, if we do this on a large scale, because Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac, as you write today, own, you know, hundreds of thousands of homes, doesn't that effectively turn the U.S. government into a landlord?
It would, and that's something that I think government policymakers are very keen to avoid. So one of the things they're looking at is there a way we can do this without actually having to stand in the middle and be the landlord? So you have federal agencies that are very bad at selling the homes anyway, and the question is, well, could you sell them to investors rather than having to do the regular kind of listings and selling them one at a time? Sell them all to investors, and then investors would have to agree to rent the homes as a condition of that sale. And so they would rent them out for a number of years. You could peg it to market conditions before they could sell. And that way, you're getting the benefit of getting these houses off the market, but the government doesn't have to stand there and fix plumbing issues or repair leaky roofs and things that landlords have to do.
Right. You're cautious in your article today, saying that it's just a plan and people are talking about it. Does it have enough support to maybe go someplace?
I think the next few months we'll get a better idea of whether this can actually move. I think it sounds great on paper. People like it on paper. But as we've learned through this housing crisis, a lot of the things that the government will do, whether it's mortgage modifications or tax credits or refinancing underwater borrowers, these plans sound great on paper. But when you actually do them, they can get fouled up pretty quickly. So I think maybe we'll see a pilot project later this year, do a few thousand homes. And if the concept can translate, then they will scale it up.
Nick Timmeros from the Wall Street Journal. Nick, thanks a lot.
Thanks, Kai, for having me.
ComScore, the website traffic measuring people, said today that Google Plus has had 20 million people visit the site in just the past couple of weeks. Late yesterday, Google itself said tens of thousands of businesses have applied to start their own profiles. Google has told all but a select few of them to wait just a little bit. Eventually, though, companies are going to have to figure out how to be on G Plus and Facebook and Twitter and all the rest. So really, what could one more social network cost them anyway? Marketplace's Jennifer Collins went to find out.
Daddy's Board Shop in Portland, Oregon is a hands-on kind of place. The company assembles almost all of the skateboards and snowboards it sells. Sarah Loveland is in charge of marketing.
Over here at the assembly bench, we have a custom longboard.
A longboard is kind of like a skateboard, but longer.
We're the Earth's largest longboard store.
Daddy's is the size of a small supermarket. Most of Daddy's hundreds of orders a day are online. A lot of its customers come through Facebook. Loveland spends about $6,000 a year on Facebook ads. But the real investment is her time, because customers are always watching the social network.
I won't check it for the day, or I won't check it all weekend, and then I'll come in on Monday and respond to everyone. And they're already like, Daddy's isn't answering questions? And it's like, no, I have other things I need to do.
Like filling orders or keeping up with other social media. 10 years ago, Daddy's connected with customers through a blog. It's had a MySpace page. It offered a deal on Groupon. Now it has a Twitter feed. Daddy's tries everything. So when Google Plus started, Loveland wanted to join that, too.
I've never kind of felt the urgency like this before.
And if Daddy's Board Shop is feeling the urgency when a giant like Google draws a reported 20 million people, just imagine what Visa, Apple, and Pepsi are feeling. Jonathan Haber is Chief Innovation Officer with OMD, which handles advertising strategy for those companies. In social media, strategy involves applications, games, sweepstakes, news feeds, and tweets. And all that strategizing requires a lot of people like Sarah Loveland.
You can spend anywhere from, $100,000 a year to many millions of dollars a year.
When a new social media player shows up, Haber says the big companies have to figure out how to use it. For instance, Google Plus lets a lot of people video chat at the same time. Google calls it a hangout. Companies want to use it for customer service. Ford has already set up a profile on Google Plus. MTV is there. Steve Jobs is there, or actually three or four people claiming to be him. Ian Schaefer's there, too. He's the CEO of interactive marketing agency Deep Focus.
Brands are very quick to rush into something that is, the flavor of the month.
So I have to think that there had to be some people sitting inside boardrooms who were like, oh, no, not another one.
I guarantee that's what was happening. And I guarantee it's also they're fearing the social media ninja that's going to be knocking on their door saying, I've got a Google Plus strategy for you.
A ninja who will gladly help you out for, say, $5,000 a week. I'm Jennifer Collins for Marketplace.
Even before it officially launched, Google Plus was such a hot ticket that people were blogging and tweeting like crazy to get invited in. Commentator Rob Walker had no such problems.
I felt a bit smug because I had an early invite, but just as I was about to accept, I noticed a post by a tech blogger explaining why he had just quit Google Plus. That's right, while the rest of us were clamoring to be early adopters, this guy was so far ahead of the curve that he'd already abandoned the new thing. He was an alpha quitter. The alpha quitter is sort of the evil twin of the early adopter, the first to declare that a given technology or product is obsolete, doomed, or has at least jumped the shark. Think of the first wave of people making a big deal about committing MySpace aside a few years ago. They deleted their accounts when that site still seemed unstoppable. Part of being an alpha quitter isn't just the quitting, it's quitting in a public way. Like early adopters who flaunt their hot new gadgets, alpha quitters are at least partly motivated by tech age status signaling. This is why certain people feel compelled to let you know that they don't own a television set. Yeah, they watch Glee, but on an iPad. Before that, they found reason to mention that they didn't have a telephone landline, and I assume they're descended from the first people to abandon buggy whips. But being an alpha quitter is riskier than it sounds. Remember Quit Facebook Day last year? Maybe not, since it didn't exactly spell the end of the world's largest social network, and even many of those who did leave the service later came skulking back. In other words, that Google Plus alpha quitter may have to swallow his pride if the service takes off. I have no predictions because I never did accept that invite. Clearly, I was too late to be on the cutting edge, so now I'll just sit back and let the early adopters and the alpha quitters duke it out and tell me what the future looks like. Meanwhile, I'll be beta testing Facebook Plus Plus, Google Multiplied, and Twitter to the power of pi.
Rob Walker is a contributing writer for the New York Times Magazine and Design Observer. Send us your comments, marketplace.org. Click on that link that says contact.
Marketplace is supported by Reputation.com, helping small business owners, professionals, and executives monitor, protect, and improve their online reputations. Reputation.com. By Fox Searchlight Pictures, presenting the new film Snowflower and the Secret Fan, based on the novel by Lisa See. From Wayne Wong, the director of the Joy Luck Club, now playing in select theaters. And by Putnam Investments, offering long-term strategies built on experience and research. On the web at putnam.com/largecapequity. Additional support from the University of Southern California's Marshall School of Business.
Finally now, on a Friday, yeah, enough with the real news. A minute for the stuff that didn't quite make the headlines, courtesy of Brendan Francis Noonan, Rico Galliano, and the rest of the Marketplace staff.
Ethan Lindsay, producer of the Marketplace Morning Report. What story are you going to be talking about this weekend?
There's a chain of hotels, the Crown Plaza. They're hiring snore patrols to come check on noisy sleepers.
They, like, roused you out of bed or something?
They're going to walk floor by floor, listening for egregious snores, knock on doors, and tell them to quiet down.
That is, like, the worst part-time job I can imagine. What do you do for a living? I wake people up who've paid to sleep.
I perform the same job that a little tab on your nose does.
Patty Hirsch, senior editor for Marketplace. What story are you going to be talking about this weekend?
I'm going to talk about this poor, unfortunate guy who had a Google account and went to check his mail one day and find that his entire Google account had been erased. 7 years of history on Google, correspondence, documents, the whole nine yards, no trace.
Did he contact Google?
He did, and they were extremely unhelpful. In fact, they haven't been helpful at all.
You know, actually, erasing 7 years of your life isn't necessarily a bad thing, you know? Maybe this is like Google time travel, lets you go back in time and fix mistakes and make better investments.
Yeah, that's Google plus plus, right?
Google minus. Stacey Vanek-Smith, senior reporter for Marketplace. What's your story?
Well, Brendan, I think you might have to cancel your trip to Cornwall.
To Cornwall?
Yeah.
I didn't know I was going.
Yeah, there's a beach town in the British county of Cornwall. They've launched this no-nonsense campaign.
Uh-huh.
So they're cracking down on drinking, and they confiscated a man's mankini. You can no longer wear a mankini.
So a mankini is like that male bathing suit thong that Borat made famous, right?
Slingshot. Looks a little bit like a slingshot.
Well, I'm glad you told me before I packed, because that was taking up all this room in the coin pocket of my jeans.
There is oh so much more where that came from. It's a podcast that Rico and Brendan do called Dinner Party Download. You can find the link on our website. It's marketplace.org. And that's it. That's Marketplace from APM American Public Media this Friday. Today, the Dow fell 43 points, about a third of 1%. The NASDAQ up 24 points, nearly 0.9%. The S&P 500 gained a point. That is 0.1%. Our theme music was composed by BJ Lederman. Marketplace is produced by Celeste West, and the executive producer is JJ Yore. Coming up this weekend on our personal financial Marketplace Money, free financial advice is great, right? Except when they're yelling at you.
I want you to sell the house. You don't need, forget about it. You don't need, you listen to me. The house is too much. I want you to sell the house.
I don't know. I think that one was crying in the background. I don't know. I'm Kai Rizdahl. We are back here on Monday. Have yourselves a great weekend. This is APM, American Public Media.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.